I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. Rag Radio is comes your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. on Co-op, which is a very, very interesting phenomenon, a very cool radio station. It's a it's cooperatively run, an all-volunteer community station that's run by the people who work here. So we're a co-op. But co-op is spelled K-O-O-P. We're streamed live from the radio station. We are also rebroadcast by WFTE in Mount Cobb in Scranton, Pennsylvania on Sunday mornings, and by KPFT on their HD3 channel in Houston on Wednesday afternoons. So you can go to, if you miss it, we'll put up a podcast. It should be up within the next day or two. So you can always listen to the show. If you get called out during the show, you can still catch everything. Tracy Schultz is my engineer and co-conspirator. Tracy, how are you doing?
Doing well, doing well. Happy
hey,
to be here.
Hey, Tracy, did you see Invasion of the Body Snatchers?
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the concept?
Yeah, I think I've familiar with that one. Yeah,
you
Donald
know,
Sutherland.
I think one of those pods was in the White House.
Oh,
there's some
really?
New guy there.
Oh.
It's amazing. We have a new Barack Obama. Very, very interesting what's going on. Okay, that's our little bit of commentary. I'm really honored to have these guests today, Raj Patel and Tom Philpott. Tom has been on the show before. I think Raj and Tom are actually thinking about or sort of, you know, playing with the idea of doing a show themselves. And in, at the very least, we will certainly have them back again. Raj, and there's too much to say about each of them, to actually say it all. But Raj Patel is an award-winning writer, activist, and academic. He is a research professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas and a senior research associate at the Unit for the Humanities at Rhodes University in South Africa. He has degrees from the University of Oxford, the London School of Economics, and Cornell University. He's worked for the World Bank and WTO, and points out that he's also protested against both of them worldwide. He's written widely. His book, The Value of Nothing, is a New York Times bestseller at this time. So, and he's also currently working on a groundbreaking documentary about the global food system with award-winning director Steve James. Tom Philpott is food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones and the co-founder of Maverick Farms, a center for sustainable food education in Valley Crucis,
that's right,
North Carolina. And he was a columnist, food editor, and senior food writer for Grist. His work on food politics has appeared in the New York Times, Newsweek, The Guardian, all kinds of places. Just to skip down, Maverick Farms has been featured in Gourmet and the New York Times and Food and Wine, and New York Times and Food and Wine named Philpott one of 10 innovators who will continue to shape the culinary consciousness of our country for the next 30 years. I don't know when that was. Are some of those years already up?
2008.
So
yes,
so the next 20.
Yeah.
So, in 2011, Utney Reader named him one of 25 visionaries who are changing your world. And we've had two of those visionaries on Rag Radio.
Excellent.
Now, so that's very, very cool. All right, ladies and gentlemen, the click and clack of food politics.
I have no idea.
Raj Patel and Tom Philpott. Welcome to Rag Radio.
Good to be here.
Thanks so much, Tom.
It's very, very cool. And these guys, I mean, I was thinking about just going and taking a nap. And just opening the mic.
Because we would send you to sleep, Thorne.
Already.
Not because they're going to put us to sleep. But they made some suggestions about stuff to do on the show, which I think will make an absolutely wonderful show. And so I'm just going to sort of jump in when I'm needed. The first thing that we're going to talk about is the massive drought, especially the California drought, which Tom is writing about, has written about. In fact, I've got some quotes, which I probably won't even read because I'm an old print guy, so I have to print out all this stuff. But he's written about for Mother Jones. I've got excerpts from September 3rd, April 2014, October 10th, 2014. He said last summer, 2014 has brought uncomfortable, late summer 2014 has brought uncomfortable news for residents of the U.S. Southwest, and I'm not talking about 109-degree heat in population centers like Phoenix. A new study by Cornell University and the U.S. Geological Survey looks at the deep historical record and the latest climate change models to estimate the likelihood of major droughts in the Southwest over the next century. The results are as soothing as a thick wool sweater on a midsummer desert hike. earlier, he said California is locked in an epochal drought, and yet produce aisles nationwide still brim with reasonably priced fruit and vegetables from the Golden State. How does California continue providing half of U.S. grown vegetables under such parched conditions? A question that we are interested in. And most recently, he says, let's take one of the globe's most important agricultural regions, one with severe water constraints and a fast-dropping water table, and let's set up shop there with highly water-intensive form of fossil fuel extraction, fracking, one that throws off copious amounts of toxic wastewater. Nothing could possibly go wrong, right? So there's three articles, excerpt from three articles. Tell us about the drought. Both of you.
Sure. Well, I just wanted to start out by saying that, so California is the source of, like Thorne was saying, about half or probably more of our fruits and vegetables, a huge amount of our nuts, probably just about all the nuts we eat. Come from there.
Actually, almonds are causing the drought. Is that right?
Almonds are not probably causing the drought, but almonds are an interesting topic. I have a story in the current Mother Jones magazine, not online yet, about the almond industry and what sort of it's doing. But the point I want to make is that we are incredibly reliant on this region for our fruits and vegetables, and it's basically the main place where they grow food in California is called the Central Valley. Well, there's two main regions, the Central Valley and the Imperial Valley. The Imperial Valley is in the south, and it's where most of our winter vegetables come from. And they're both essentially deserts, and they rely on this massive and amazing bit of infrastructure that brings water from the snow melt of the Sierra Nevadas down south to the Central Valley and to the Imperial Valley. Well, let's take the Imperial Valley out of that for a second, to the Central Valley. And the problem is that with climate change, the amount of snow melt that actually happens is vanishing. And we're right now in a period of, we're in the fourth year of a time with incredibly low snow melt. But even apart from the current drought, the snow melt is tapering down. So the amount of available water in California is decreasing with time and is expected to continue decreasing with time. The way they're making up for that, and we're talking about big industrial farms here, the way they're making up for that is by tapping groundwater, the underground aquifer water that you can sort of think of as fossil water. It's not going to be replaced anytime soon. And the thing about it is that you can think of it as a bank account that you want to hold in reserve. And what we're doing now to keep it going is tapping that bank account at an incredibly fast pace. And so that's, one of the major so this is a climate change crisis affecting our food that isn't 20 years off or 30 years off. It's not somewhere else in the global south. It's in the vegetable basket of the United States. And maybe in a second we'll talk about the problem happening in the Corn Belt, which is where all of our sort of non-vegetable food is mainly grown.
Okay. Raj?
Well, no, I'm curious about this sort of depletion of water happening in a seismic zone. I mean, we've got the U.S. Geological Survey saying that in fact the land has risen in California because water helps the land act like a sponge, and it's and when you take the water out, you're essentially drying out the sponge, and so the sponge gets thicker. But Tom, did you come across any stuff around the consequences of mining this water, essentially, in an area where there are some fairly serious fault lines?
I have seen conflicting reports on that. I've seen scientists express concern about it, and I've seen scientists say, "Oh no, it's not that big of a deal." So it's a little bit hard to say. But one thing that's interesting, in addition to this effect of rising that you're talking about, there's also a simultaneous, in some parts of the Central Valley, this sinking effect, where literally as the groundwater is sucked out, most of the rising is happening in the mountains. In the valleys, you're getting subsidence. And what that is the groundwater is sucked out. The ground literally sinks. It's kind of it creates a vacuum, and the ground sinks. And that causes all kinds of problems in the here and now because there's all this infrastructure. Think about bridges. Think about roads. Think about this incredible amount of dams and canals that bring this water from the Sierra Nevadas all the way down to Los Angeles. When you start getting changes in elevation that happen, you screw up that infrastructure, and it costs incredible amounts of money to fix it. And so the groundwater pumping is creating problems with the infrastructure that brings the surface water down, creating more need for pumping groundwater. So you get this sort of feedback loop effect going on, which is happening right now.
But this I guess what. I mean, this weather doesn't come with a big label on it saying, hello, this is climate change at work. I mean, and it's still possible for people to say, well, you know, this could be cyclical, or this is an aberrant moment in the history. And we look at the geological record that goes back 6,000 years and this is just God hugging us a little closer or whatever it is. Is there a way of passing this in a way to make it sort of unequivocally clear that this is, in fact, climate change?
I mean, I think if you look at the temperature patterns in a place like California or anywhere in the United States or anywhere in the world, basically, you're getting, every year, new records for heat. One of the things that was kind of lost in the shuffle of last year's drought was that I believe the year 2014 has been one of the hottest years on record in California. So in addition to this lack of winter snowfall, which drives the entire system, you also got an incredibly hot summer, thus sort of making it even worse. And something else about the deep historical record is that there's a woman at Berkeley, a paleoclimatologist, who studied the record, and what she found was that the 20th century was actually an incredibly wet century in the history of California. So if you think about it, our entire infrastructure for fruit and vegetables was built in this aberration period. And what we're seeing in addition to climate change is we're seeing what's probably a reversion to mean. And so what she's saying is that we're probably going to have about 15, if we revert to mean in this century, we'll have about 15% less available water in California. And then when you add climate change to the mix, that means the mix goes from less snow to more rain. And snow is like gold for agriculture because snow, it accumulates, it can essentially be banked, and then it melts at a predictable time, and it goes into this infrastructure. The infrastructure is built to capture snow melt, and it does way less good with rain. And so you're getting less overall water and more rain and less snow in the mix, meaning that this 20th century infrastructure that we built up is going to come under increasing pressure.
Okay, by the way, folks can see why I'm not really needed here. you've been listening to Tom Philpott and Raj Patel. I want to step back for a minute here. The title of this show, or the sort of the subject matter that we the way we promoted it in the newsletter, is that Are We Cooked? Ways of Thinking About Food and Climate. And I'd like to look at the larger picture for a minute and how the two interrelate. And certainly that's what you're talking about when you're talking about the drought. But I know that, Raj, you wrote an article about the Mozambique food riots and the larger question of how climate change is going to create instability all over the world, not only in food supply, but in all kinds of, how that then leads to war. I mean, famine, all kinds of things. And when we look forward, and as we see, climate change is certainly not something we're reversing anytime soon. Give us a larger picture.
Here's a story. One of the ways in which farmers, for example, in Iowa, and I think we should talk about the Midwest, the ways that farmers in Iowa, according to the Financial Times, thought about climate change was not as a symptom of too many greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, but as a problem with the subsidies system. So, you know, and you can see how farmers would think that, right? I mean, you've invested in growing row upon row upon row of corn. The price of corn is going haywire. There's just a lot of volatility, lots of ups and downs in the price. And the one thing that you're banking on is some sort of safety net and some sort of subsidy system that's going to remain intact. And climate change is taxing all of that and pushing that to the brink. But I think that helps us understand that the way that everyone experiences climate change is not as a thunderbolt with a little tag attached to it from some divine entity saying this is climate change, have a nice day, but it's much more about an experience as a social shock. So, for example, in Syria, it's what happens after 3 years of drought, and then you start seeing an uprising. You see the Arab Spring as the outcome of swings in wheat prices. And then there's this really interesting story in Mozambique. So let me just tell you this, because it blows my mind that what we saw in Mozambique a couple of years ago were bread riots. And people took to the streets in Mozambique, in Maputo and a few other sort of larger cities, demanding cheaper wheat. And the government did its best to be able to make that happen. Unfortunately, the government wasn't able to make that happen. And the police ended up killing a dozen or so people. The reason the police gave is that they had to use live ammunition because they ran out of rubber bullets. Mull over that as you will. What's interesting is why, first of all, what are Mozambicans doing demanding bread? Where does the taste for bread come from? Because wheat isn't native to Mozambique. The reason Mozambicans want bread is because of a history of colonialism by the Portuguese. Okay, we've got the history of colonialism there. Let's put that on one side. But then the question is, so why did the price of wheat go up? And it's a really interesting story about climate change, finance, and food. And the story is this, that Russia had gone through austerity, right? This was in the middle of the Great Recession. Like other places, Russia had cut back on what it deemed non-essential public services, things like firefighters. So it had cut back the number of firefighters. It also tried to balance its fiscal books by selling off concessions to loggers. And so you had loggers who were logging indiscriminately and leaving stumps on the ground. You had no firefighters, and you had a very, very hot summer, which led to massive wildfires in the world's grain basket. So you now have Russia, one of the world's major wheat growers, ending, but basically they said, all right, well, fine, we're going to have an export ban. We're going to stop exporting wheat. And that export ban may or may not have been influenced by a large grain trading company called Glencore that met with Russia a couple of days before this ban was implemented. But the point is, you have a fire in Russia caused by climate change and austerity politics. That results in a grain export ban. That results in a rise in the price of wheat. That results in Mozambique not being able to afford to buy wheat. And all of a sudden, you have food riots in Mozambique. And it's all connected by this global trade system.
I don't know where I learned, somewhere in my limited education, to call it Mocambique, but I'm obviously wrong. I love what you said, and we need to take a break, but you wrote in this article, you said behind the 2008 protests were first natural events that looked like an excerpt from the meteorological section of the Book of Revelation. Drought in Australia, crop disease in Central Asia, floods in Southeast Asia. You said these were compounded by the social systems through which their effects were felt. So it's all very complicated and interrelated, but it's something we certainly have to start dealing with, right? Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. Raj Patel and Tom Philpott are my guests. We'll be right back.
Bad news on the doorstep. I couldn't take one more step. I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride, but something touched me deep inside the day the music died. So bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die. Did you you write the book of love, and do you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so, how do you believe in rock and roll? Can music save your mortal soul? And can you teach me how to dance real slow? Shoes. Man, I dig those rhythm and blues. I was a lonely teenage bronc and buck with a pink carnation and a pickup truck. But I knew I was out of luck the day the music died. I started singing bye bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. That I die.
All right, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio, when we're back with Raj Patel and Tom Philpott. Tracy, by the way, wow, yes. What a song that is! What a song that has been for so long, and how prescient, you know, its story.
Huh? Yeah.
Bye, bye, Miss American Pie, and we've been saying goodbye for a while.
And food related in a roundabout.
Roundness.
Apple pie, literal way.
Okay. Tom, you wanted, we've been talking about the larger picture, I guess, to an extent. And we had Mike Davis. We brought Mike Davis to town recently, the author and sociologist and whatever. I mean, all kind of urban anthropologists. And you wanted, and we had him on the show.
Right.
Phenomenal, chronicler of the apocalypse.
Yes.
So what were you going, you had something
I just wanted to say that I unfortunately had to miss that event. I was out of town the one day that he's in town. But the fact that he was here inspired me to pick up my old copy of Late Victorian Holocausts, which is a phenomenal book. It's probably remains still the uber book written about food and climate, even though it's about the 19th century. It's about basically the intersections of climate change, food, politics, power relations. And so the book is, I don't know if you guys discussed it on the show, but the book is about the El Nino events in South Asia in the 19th century and the way that they caused monsoon failures. So this sort of natural event, this natural happening, that they caused monsoon failures that were turned by politics into human disasters, massive, massive famines. Millions of people died in the British Raj in India under the rule of the Brits. And he shows how, in many of these cases, India would remain a net food exporter. So there'd be a monsoon failure in part of the country. So there'd be a massive crop failure, but other parts of the country would still have wheat growing. And that wheat would go to the highest bidder under the sort of ironclad rules of Adam Smith, which would be back in the mother country of England. And so you'd get these events. I think there were three events in the 19th century in the subcontinent of these climate change events creating massive, massive unrest. And the British government used them to consolidate its grip over the Indian colony in the 19th century. It's just an incredible book that combines science, political analysis, historical analysis, all under one roof.
Yeah, Mike is the editor of, I mean, the author of a number of really important books. City of Quartz, of course, is the best known. Planet of Slums, but there's a whole lot more.
But in our field, I think Raj and I are both.
I mean, it's a work of monumental genius to be able to just take these El Nino cycles that happen every sort of 7 or so years and observe that at the beginning of the 19th century, India was just as rich as Europe. And by the end of the 19th century, 30 million people were dead. You had the golden dawn of enlightened international capitalism, and India was immiserated. And to be able to use these natural weather shocks as kind of insights into what's happening in the social system, I think is super important, because that brings us back to today, to be thinking about, well, how is it? You asked at the beginning of the show, how is it that we can have these cheap vegetables and still California is in all kinds of turmoil? Well, it's not that. I mean, one of the reasons is because farmers don't get anywhere near the full cost of what we pay the supermarket for their vegetables. There's an entire distribution system.
That's where we get into the economic system's role in the whole thing. So
yeah, and the same topic as that, Raj. There's also the problem of farm workers. That whole industry in California is based on incredibly exploited farm workers. California farm workers do get the minimum wage, but wage theft is rampant. People live in poverty. The people who feed us in California can't afford a basic diet year round, which is just an incredible fact to think about. And you know, the other thing that's keeping it going during this drought is this extraction, this drawing down of fossil water resources that simply can't go on forever.
And it's also been balanced on the back of future generations of workers in California. I mean, you know, one of the shifts that's happened since the 60s is, because of demands not to be poisoned by consumers saying, well, we don't want to be eating the kinds of things that Rachel Carson is complaining about in Silent Spring. The profile of pesticides has changed. And so now you have pesticides that are incredibly toxic at the point of application, which are then sort of washed away. But the long-term effects for workers is incredible. I mean, the Brenda Eskenazi at the University of California at Berkeley has observed a 7-point drop in IQ points for children of workers exposed to these kinds of pesticides. And so our vegetables remain cheap and sort of photogenic, while at the cost of children's futures in California in the fields.
You know, it's a shame we can't go into. We could have taken just one of these subjects and done the whole show. Mm-hmm. And next time, maybe we will focus in on something. One of the things that you wanted to talk about was how bad ways to respond to this problem we face, and GMOs was one of them that you mentioned. But I'd like for you, before we get into how not to respond. I would like for each of you to kind of pose for us the problem as you see it, the nature of it, the scope of it, and the future if we don't do anything.
Well, I mean, in a word, capitalism, I think, is a nice way of starting that conversation. I mean, what you have here is a concentration of market power. You have a series of very powerful corporations in a position to externalize the environmental, social costs of the way that our food reaches us. And one of the things ironic, I think, is just too light a word here. But food is both cause and deeply affected by climate change. So the way that we grow food in the 21st century, using 20th century technology, involves vast amounts of fossil fuel and an assumption of unlimited cheap water and cheap labor and land that's available and cheap as well. And of course, in the 21st century, all of those assumptions are violated. And yet you have an industrial food system that persists in proclaiming that it is the only way to feed the 9 billion, the sort of hypothetical number of people who will exist by 2050. And, I mean, there's a problem with almost every sentence that I've said there. And I think that for me, at the heart of it is a certain orientation to nature and workers that capitalism embodies.
Yeah.
And just to add to that, I'd say that the companies, you know, if you look at the food system and who controls it in any little aspect of it, in terms of chemical inputs, in terms of seeds, in terms of the companies that slaughter and pack meat, the companies that pack fruit, that pack vegetables, they're all these markets, the companies that sell vegetables at the retail level, they're all dominated by a very small set of companies, most of them publicly traded. And in the system that we have, since they control the food system, and since despite the sort of subsidies and stuff we hear about, the government say over the food system is very minimal. It's a very laissez-faire attitude. The old, like we did have for a couple of decades in this country, we did have a sort of a national food policy that grew out of the the Great Depression, that was basically dismantled starting in the 70s. And ever since then, we've basically had a laissez-faire approach to food policy. And as a result, these companies have very, very clear incentives to maximize profit for the next quarter. And so you're looking, if you're looking at a problem that requires you to have a bit of a decades-long view of things, what's going to happen if we keep doing this for the next 10 years, for the next 20 years, for the next 30 years? These kinds of questions can't really be asked by these companies. Almost legally, they're bound by their shareholders to maximize profit. And the way that the stock market has operated for a long time now, that means in the short term. And so you've got these companies that have every incentive to continue doing the same things that they've been doing very profitably for decades now. And so you've got this momentum. You've got this, you know, think of it as a gigantic ship lurching forward, and it's really hard. It takes a lot of energy to move it in any other direction. And I think some of us are thinking about sinking the ship instead of trying to change its direction.
Yeah, well, and if capitalism is the problem, or a lot of the problem, or is a way of defining the problem, you know, the answer, what is the answer? Because, I mean, is it socialism? There are no real socialist countries in the world, I don't think. Cuba, maybe. This is another long discussion.
Wow, these are big. We're getting to the big questions now.
Maybe we can't. Maybe that's too much for us to go off into right now. So, but
well, I mean, but even you know, when people say, "Well, if you hate capitalism so much, go to Cuba." I mean, Cuba has its own series of very interesting contradictions around food and climate. So, for example, immediately after the fall of the Soviet Union, Cuba had some really interesting. They had some tough challenges, right? It was the lean years where, because Cuba wasn't getting any more cheap gas or oil from the Soviet Union, people went hungry, and it was not a pleasant place to be. But they also invented alternatives to industrial agriculture, like agroecology, where you plant instead of one crop, a monoculture, you plant lots of crops together, a polyculture, and that helps build soil fertility. It helps sequester carbon. It helps make your land much more robust when disaster does happen. And the trouble is that, of course, Cuba now is best buddies with Venezuela. And Venezuela, when I was in Cuba a year and a half ago, Venezuela, I saw, was busily exporting natural gas and fossil fuel back to Cuba. And Cuba was readopting some of its old bad industrial agricultural habits in exchange for Cuban doctors off to Caracas to help fight poverty and the diseases associated with it. So it's a very interesting. I mean, even if you look to the one state where you might unambiguously say that it's socialist, even there, some of the old socialist ideas about commanding and controlling nature have reasserted themselves in some fairly unpleasant ways, and certainly not enlightened ways when it comes to climate change.
Right. If we're talking about anything, it's what they're now calling 20th century socialism, which is doesn't really exist anywhere yet. So, but we're going to have to just touch on some things because there are a lot of things I'd really love to talk about, and we will do this again soon. Tell us briefly why GMOs are not an answer.
Oh,
can we do that briefly?
Yeah,
if we go can. On, we can go on. We can. We don't have to hit everything.
I mean, the thing about them is. It's kind of hard to think of where to start, but...
Do they work?
Well, they really kind of don't work. They end up being kind of a bad technology they're built on the idea of this sort of linear idea between genes and traits. That the whole industry is built on this idea that we can take a gene from one organism and plant it into another organism and get these fantastic traits. What they found when they mapped the human genome was that human beings have far fewer genes than people thought before they actually mapped it. And, stuff like the Pinot Noir grape, for example, has more genes than a human being. And as much as I love the Pinot Noir grape,
as complex and wonderful
as it is, it probably isn't as complex of an organism as a human being. What that's telling us is that the whole sort of relationship between genes and traits is way more complicated, way more mysterious, way more work needs to be done to understand it. And so what the companies have managed to do, 20 years into commercialization, is basically bring two big traits to market. And those traits are insecticide, to sort of put an insecticide into the tissue of the crop, and herbicide resistance. Those are the big commercial successes. And both those things have proved to be very fragile. And, the other thing is that classical breeding, and even high-tech versions of classical breeding, is way cheaper and way more robust, it turns out, and even at least as fast as GMO technology. And, things like, drought tolerance, let's say. That's going to be an important, figuring out how to grow crops that tolerate drought is going to be important going forward. And it turns out that there's no gene that, let's say, let's take a gene from a cactus and put it into wheat, and therefore we'll have this incredibly drought-tolerant wheat. Well, it doesn't work that way. We're talking, Raj and I were talking to a plant scientist from Texas A&M whose name is, you remember her name?
Jane
Deaver. And she was, kind of using that example. And the way that plants take up more, take up water and use water is extremely complex. And when you do that, if you were to theoretically do that transfer, by the time you got cactus-style drought tolerance into wheat, you'd basically have cactus again. You would be transforming. You would be bringing so many genes over that what you get would be very much like a cactus. But it also turns out that wheat has been grown for a long time, and it's been grown in arid climates for years and years. And in the biodiversity of wheat that exists, in the wild relatives of wheat that still exists, what biodiversity we have not managed to kill, because we've killed a lot of biodiversity in the last century. There are traits in existing wheat that are actually very drought tolerant. And so that's one thing. And so bringing these traits to market are actually way cheaper than GMOs. The other thing is that agroecology, which is sort of just, doing agriculture in a smart way, using polycultures, using things like cover crops, agroecology can get immediate, like the next growing season, amounts of drought tolerance just by putting organic matter, building organic matter in soil. And the thing about putting organic matter in soil is that it not only makes the soil hold together more if you get a flood, which we're going to get more floods with climate change, it not only makes helps soil trap water better for a dry season, and we're going to have more droughts, but it also takes carbon out of the atmosphere, reducing climate change. And so this is one way that agriculture could not contribute to climate change, but actually help slow down climate change.
Okay, Raj, do you have anything to add to that? We need to go to break in about 30 seconds. So,
well, I mean, I agree with Tom. And there's a slogan for this, which is that small farmers cool the planet. I mean, the kinds of systems that Tom's talking about are ones that farmers around the world who aren't following the industrial model are using right now, and they're a great hope.
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My guests are Raj Patel and Tom Philpott. Tracy Schultz is my engineer. Take it away, Tracy.
You know I love that organic cooking. I always ask for more. And they call me Mr. Natural on down to the health food store. I only eat good sea salt, white sugar don't touch my lips. And my friends is always begging me to take them on macrobiotic trips. Yes, they are. All but night I take out my strong box that I keep under lock and key. And I take it off to my closet where nobody else can see. I open that door so slowly, take a peek up north and south. Then I pull out a Hostess Twinkie and I pop it in my mouth. Yeah, in the daytime I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. But at night I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me. Well, at lunchtime you can always find me at the Whole Earth Vitamin Bar, just sucking on my plain white yogurt from a hand-thrown pottery jar. And sipping little hand-pressed cider with a carrot stick for dessert. And wiping my face in a natural way on the sleeve of my peasant shirt. Oh, yeah. Ah, but when that clock strikes midnight and I'm all by myself, I work at Combination on my secret hideaway shelf, and I pull out some Fritos corn chips, Dr. Pepper, and an old moon pie. Then I sit back in glorious expectation of a genuine junk food high.
Woo! Tracy, is that you?
Yeah, a little.
You go for that moon pie late at night?
I think it's Raj.
Moon pie, yeah.
Are you I need to know what moon pie is. Someone needs to explain that to
me. We'll tell you later. We'll tell you later. It's kind of a sort of cultural phenomenon.
I imagine it is, yes. So.
Okay, Tracy, you don't even bother with the first part, right?
Oh,
healthy
plain
the healthy
yogurt
part.
From yeah. my hand thrown yeah. pot. No. Right.
Okay, I'm hand thrown pot here. No, that's something else. Okay.
The hand thrown potty. It's right around. The I'm sorry. Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer, Rag Radio. My guests are Raj Patel and Tom Philpott, and we're talking about climate and food. Basically, are we cooked? Ways of thinking about food and climate. We're not going to be able to cover everything we wanted to, which is always the sign of a good show. And I'm enjoying this immensely. But we're going to do a couple of things. The first thing I want to do is we always get a lot of mail from people all over the place. And one listener sent us Jordan Buckley sent a question for our guests. Said, farm worker leader Nelly Rodriguez of the Coalition of Immokalee workers. I asked this earlier, and I don't expect me to remember things very long. Workers will be in. It's coming to Austin for a protest at Wendy's,
right.
And Raj and Tom have both been there to Immokalee to meet with leaders. And for many years, both of you have employed your gift for writing to illuminate the campaign to a far broader audience, a collective effort that's resulted in a dozen multi-billion-dollar food retailers, including Walmart, to sign on for better pay and working conditions for tens of thousands of Florida tomato harvesters. You guys are responsible for that. So what are my guests' thoughts on the CIW's Fair Food Program today, and why has Wendy's been among the only of the nation's five largest fast food chains not willing to sign on?
Well, the first thing I would say is when we think about a challenge like climate change, mm-hmm. and how daunting it is and how much momentum it is and how powerful these companies are, and it just seems so impossible to do anything about. One of the things that I think about is the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, because they have face down those very companies. And I remember first reading about them in the mid-2000s thinking, oh, well, this is a nice effort, but how are they ever going to get McDonald's and Burger King? These companies profit by pinching pennies. That's their entire business model, is pinching pennies. And how are you going to get a penny a pound for farm workers from these companies that fight tooth and nail for their shareholders? And one by one, they drop like flies. And so there's actually a movie out now called Food Chains that I might be opening in Austin soon, but will certainly be on Netflix at a certain point.
Right.
And it's about the CIW. And, you can see it as an organizing manual about how to take on these companies and win.
Okay.
And, I mean, there's always going to be companies that are on the wrong side of history. I mean, again, if we're thinking about climate change, we wouldn't expect, Exxon or, these sort of oil giants to suddenly come to their senses in anything other than a PR term and recognize that what they're doing is destructive of all life on Earth and therefore to leave fossil fuel in the ground. But again, as you say, what's exciting about the CIW is that they played a long game and they mobilized in a way that I think we absolutely need to be thinking about in terms of climate justice. And it's already happening in terms of climate justice. Going to churches, going to student groups, going to a range of communities, and just pointing out that a penny per pound doesn't mean that all of a sudden farm workers are driving around in Bentleys. And this is still, it's above a minimum wage, but it's what, $24,000 a year is the average wage now. This isn't mountains of money by any stretch of the imagination. And that's why I think that the Fair Food Program is an important step, but it's not, we haven't reached the promised land. And I think that it's an important victory that's going to help seal and provide a platform for future organizing. And that's the way we have to think about climate change, too.
Are there victories like that are happening that should cause us to be encouraged in light of the massive nature of the problem?
I would say the reason why there is not a Keystone pipeline cutting through the heart of the country and heading down all the way to the Gulf is because of social movements. Although we do have the southern half built, which is a monstrosity. The reason why the northern half isn't there is because of social movements, I'd say. So yeah. I think that's pretty important.
Yeah, especially Native American.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Okay. The next thing we want to talk about is you said we'd like to spend the last chunk of the show, which is what this is. Talking about ways to grow and distribute food that don't involve the industrial food system. Lay it on us.
Raj, you've been around the world recently kind of discussing, kind of reporting on that very topic. So why don't you...
What we've seen, first of all, is that everywhere in the world is up against climate change, whether you're a farmer in the Peruvian highlands or you're in the dry lands of Malawi or you're living in Maine, frankly. I mean, there's everywhere in the world is touched by this. But the kinds of answers that people have to the problem of climate change is just, it's reassuring that they recognize, that so many people recognize this is a systemic problem. And what you need are systemic solutions. So it's not about just going to your farmer's market or buying something with the appropriate labels on it.
Or recycling your own.
Well, and of course, recycling is a good thing and going to the farmer's market is a good thing, other things being equal. But what we need is systemic change. And so the kinds of systemic change look like a term that's called food sovereignty. It has a long definition, but basically the idea is more democratic control of this food system and a shorter distance between farmers and growers, and more support for farmers and more support for growers. So as well as making sure that we pay the full environmental costs of our food, we need to pay the full labor costs. And that means, one suggestion is to have a global maximum wage and a global minimum wage. This is the work of Thomas Piketty, the French economist who's popularized an idea that's been around for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. But the idea is, if we're going to fight climate change, we need to first of all recognize that our food system doesn't work, as Tom said so wonderfully, by pinching pennies from the poorest people and stealing from the planet. And instead, we have to respect both the earth and the social systems that provide our food in a way that makes sure that everyone gets paid and everyone can afford to eat.
Okay.
Right, and I think that the concept of food sovereignty is a really powerful lens, and it's not saying that we should block trade in food or we should only eat within 100 miles. I think all those ideas are kind of ridiculous. We've never had a world where food wasn't traded, where people ate only within 100 miles. Not in recent times. But the idea is what Raj said about bringing democracy into the food system. And that means, having like a public say in what food policy is, which is something we do not have in the United States. I've been writing about food politics for about 10 years now, and I remember getting really excited about farm bills, which are these every 5 year federal, this federal law that gets passed every 5 years that makes food policy. And you think about it as this opportunity, and especially in a time of austerity, the government has, between, let's say, $5 and $20 billion a year to spend on agriculture policy. Well, that's a pretty good amount of money. You think, of smart, cool things that it could do with that. And when you dive into farm bill details, as I have in, I think, the last three farm bills, you find out that it is completely bought and paid for before debate ever even starts. And any kind of smart idea that we could come up to with right now is not part of the debate with the farm bill. And what the farm bill does is just sort of enshrines this system of maximizing production, of the sort of mining of the land in places like California and the Midwest. And so food sovereignty is a way of, it's a way of thinking about it. It's a goal to get us thinking about how to get democracy into the food system. And Raj, have you been anywhere where you think food sovereignty is coming into focus?
Well, I mean, there are lots of places where you see food sovereignty in national constitutions. I mean, you've everywhere from Ecuador to Nepal. I mean, the term appears as a matter of national policy, but people are still figuring it out. And at some level, you may say, well, that's just disappointing. You know, this is just vapid talk of using the word sovereignty, and no one really knows what it means. But on the other hand, the idea of food sovereignty itself is a process. It's not something where all of a sudden, you know, you can have a food sovereignty bill generated by one incredibly smart person who will set it down and everyone will just follow what they say. The idea of sovereignty has to be democratic, and that means it takes time. And so just like we have slow food, we should get used to slow politics. I mean, not the sort of politics that where Monsanto can just scribble down on the back of an envelope what it would quite like to see in the next farm bill, but instead a process of democracy that takes years but results in something that everyone can kind of get behind. And so, in fact, with that in mind, I wonder, I mean, one of the things that's been circulating recently is an op-ed piece in the Post, by Mark Bittman and Michael Pollan and Ricardo Salvador and Olivier Deschutes about how about we had a national food policy in the United States. And I'm wondering, Tom, what do you think of that idea?
I think the idea itself is fantastic. The idea of having, as Pollan has been saying for years, what we have is farm policy that's pretty flawed, and how about a food policy that doesn't sort of look at farms in a vacuum, but thinks of farms as entities that grow food for people to eat. And so I think the broad outlines of having a food policy would be fantastic. But I know, Raj, you had some specific critiques of the Pollan Bittman piece.
Well, I mean, I can say it on Co-op Radio, of course, that it's leftist deviationism. My worry is that when we have talk about, well, we must reduce, I mean, we must eliminate all subsidies, that actually that may get us into a place where we're not looking at who it is that needs to be supported. I mean, in Europe, for example, there's this idea of the multifunctionality of agriculture. Now, you may say, well, that's just the Europeans just making up words again. But the idea of agriculture being something that is both, you know, it produces food, but it also sustains rural communities, and it is a way of life, and it is a way for, you know, soil to sequester carbon and a bunch of other things. It's important to recognize that the market is not going to value all that stuff. What the market's going to value is just the food.
Yeah.
And so how do we figure out a food system that recognizes the value of all that other stuff? Well, at some point, someone has to pay.
One thing I figured out in my years of reporting on the Farm Bill itself is that agribusiness doesn't really care about subsidies per se. And sometimes I've argued with Michael Pollan about this before. Sometimes he makes it seem like the subsidy system is a sort of creation of agribusiness. And the thing about it is that agribusiness understands that left to their own devices, especially in these sort of big grain farms in the Midwest, farmers will overproduce. And the reason is that I'm trying to make a living off my land. So I'm going to produce as much corn as I can. And if everyone has the same mentality, the price of corn goes down a little bit. And the mentality ends up being, well, I'm going to grow more corn to make up on volume what I'm missing on price. So you get these cycles of overproduction, which is exactly what happened in the United States in the Depression era, the 1930s. You had this paradox of plenty where you had way too much food being grown on farms, and you had prices at rock bottom, and still people who couldn't afford it. And so you had this crisis, and in the New Deal, there were programs put into place to help farmers manage supply, and that the main task of agribusiness in the Farm Bill is to keep those kinds of things out. Subsidies, they'll tolerate, they're fine with them, there's no skin off of them, but what they don't want is any government hand in helping manage supply. And I think that the food movement can get simplistic about that and right. Get on this sort of anti-subsidy agenda when we need to have a public say in farm policy.
Okay, we've got about 3 minutes. So if you'd kind of sum things up and tell people, I always like to do at the end, to sort of give people an idea of what they can do or where they can learn more. Why don't you sort of sum things up? Tell us what people can do, where they can go to learn about what's going on. I don't know if you guys, do you guys have websites?
Gosh, yes.
That you do, I know, Tom. You both do. We do have websites. Actually, I've been to both of them. So why don't you tell us where those are? And I'd also know that there's an awful lot of stuff happening under the radar, and that's, I think, a little more than just recycling and, you know, I mean, and community and urban farms, although urban farms are interesting.
Well, I would start by showing up to this rally that was mentioned in your letter a second ago, which is when? This is a coalition of Immokalee workers rally.
Outside Wendy's.
It's coming
this
up.
This coming Sunday. So for those of you listening live, and I don't, this doesn't tell me, and I assume that
it's ciw-online.com or possibly .org. Google will sort you out, or whatever search engine you choose. And we're merely suggesting these. Yes, we are.
This is a great food justice thing to tap into, and a great set of people to get into. My website, I don't really have one, but I write for Mother Jones, and if you Google my name, Tom Philpott and Mother Jones, you can see all the stuff I've written. I've written some recent stuff in the California drought.
I guess that's what I did. That's how I found your stuff, rather than a website. Yeah.
And if you're interested in some of these, the international ideas around some of this, go to laviacampesina.org. And that's the international peasant movement, 200 million members, including members in the United States, who are reimagining what a future agriculture could look like. And that, to me, is tremendously inspirational.
Okay. 30 seconds.
And let me do, like, I do think that the idea of voting with your fork is way, way overrated, but it's still important. And so I do think that showing up to farmers markets here in town, showing up at farms here in town is a great idea and a great way to meet people that are doing interesting things. We need people on the ground growing food, and we do have a great base of that in Austin. And I've been hearing from farmers in Austin that we might be getting a little bit overcrowded in terms of farms, and that just means that we need more people out there buying food to help support these folks.
Good point.
Okay. All right. Hey, this has been great. Thank you so much. It really has. I think this has been incredibly informative and interesting. Tom Philpott and Raj Patel, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll
thank
do
you,
it again.
Thorn.
Thanks for having us, Thorn.
Okay. Next, we've got coming up Timothy Kooner, author of Capitalism versus Democracy, Money in Politics and the Free Market Constitution. Philip Russell on Mexico. Jesse Dayton, singer, songwriter, country singer. Got all kinds of stuff in the works. So I'm Thorn Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. Thank you.